Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
So welcome to another edition of Behind the Knife. We are absolutely thrilled to continue in our line of kind of talking about examinations and oral examinations and what's good, what's bad. And we're very pleased to have Dr. Christian Jones join us, who is an acute care surgeon in the Division of Trauma and Acute Care Emergency General Surgery. He's also at his Twitter handle, at Jones Surgery. Interesting about that, he has 2,381 followers, and he's put out 13,700 tweets. So please check him out at Jones Surgery. Christian, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's a real pleasure. You know, it's a lot easier to put out tweets than publications. So that works out well for everybody.
But you got 10,100 likes, which is awesome. So we also have Dr. David Strasberg, who's a PGY5 in his fourth clinical year at Ohio State. Go Buckeyes, not go Badgers. So David, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And Sarah Bruskowski, who's a PGY7, who is in her fifth clinical year at Rutgers University. Sarah, thanks for joining us on BTK.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So, and as always, we got the guys on the line, Kevin and Jason.
Yep.
Take it away.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Steele. We're excited. We've had a lot of great feedback in Twitter, and our listeners have been very, very excited about the mock orals. So we reached out to Dr. Jones to take us through some of his trauma and critical care scenarios. So, Dr. Jones, we really appreciate you taking the time to do this. Before we jump into the scenarios today, the trauma situations are a little bit different than the rest of the situations, and they're kind of a unique bird. Dr. Jones, can you tell us kind of a way to methodically handle these trauma situations?
Sure, absolutely, Kevin. It's absolutely imperative that you really have your trauma initial management down on the oral boards. You know, there's one thing that every single resident will see on the oral boards: breast surgery, which unfortunately isn't my specialty, but every one of them will also see a trauma critical care scenario. There used to be a trauma and critical care room. I think Dr. Blotnick talked about that on some of the prior podcasts. But now, instead of dividing it into one separate room, they can be separated over multiple rooms. You know, you're going through three different rooms. You may even theoretically end up having a trauma scenario in every single room. That's not really likely, but everybody will have at least one. Just like the basic ATLS that we all learned very, very early on and got to practice over and over and over again in residency, we're going to approach these methodically every single time. You're absolutely going to do your airway, breathing, circulation, disability. Kevin, on one of the mock oral exams that you took recently with Dr. Blotnick, you did that perfectly. You went through absolutely everything that you're supposed to. And that's exactly what I'd recommend for everybody. You know, it's really easy, especially during residency, and especially if it's not what you're planning to do for the rest of your life, to kind of take it easy in real life trauma situations where you're certainly paying attention to the patient, but you're not step by step methodically verbalizing or explicitly saying everything that you're going to do, just like you would on the boards. So when you're in these board situations, you don't have stall techniques that are going to slow everything down. You don't have techniques where you're asking, you know, what's my breathing exam, and waiting for an answer before going on to other things. But you are definitely verbalizing what's going on in that methodical airway breathing circulation scenario. Now, one thing I'll say is they will want to hear you actually say ABCs or airway breathing circulation and mention what you're checking. But in the vast majority of cases, once they realize you're doing that, they'll give you findings of an entire primary survey. And that's because they don't want to spend their time knowing that you know the intricacies of every single finding. They want to spend their time knowing that you understand the true trauma management. So be ready for them to cut you off. Be ready for them to say, okay, well, you've found all of these things. ABCs are entirely intact, and let's go on. Remember, these are fast scenarios, but that methodic, systematic approach to it not only is going to help you on your ATLS exam and help you in your initial evaluation of traumas, it's definitely going to help you on the boards to show that you really know what you're doing.
Great. Well, I think, Sarah, are you ready to step up first to try the mock scenarios
Let's
tonight?
Do it.
I think we should just give kudos to our two very brave residents that that volunteered to do this. Kevin and I did it last week. We both said some very silly things. It's out there for everybody to listen to. So it takes a lot of guts just to come on and go through these scenarios on the air. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, about 5,000 people have heard me stutter through a trauma exam now. So that's good.
So no pressure.
No big deal.
Okay, so let's get started. Sarah, we'll say that you're standing at the door of your exam room, your first exam room of the day, and we'll go through a couple scenarios. I'm going to come to the door, and of course, you're not going to knock on it. Remember, you're never knocking on these doors, whether you're talking mock orals or your final oral exams. But I'm going to open that door when we're good and ready in the room, and I'll say, hi there, Dr. Brzezkowski.
Hi, Dr. Jones. Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. Come on in, please. So we're going to go through just a couple of patient scenarios. I want to make sure you understand there's no gotchas, there's no tricks here. I'd really just like to discuss the management of a couple of patients. Tell me what you would do in real life, and don't hesitate to ask questions. But if I tell you that you've got all the information you need, no reason to prod for more. I promise I'm not going to hold anything back from you intentionally.
Okay.
Ready to get started?
Let's do it.
Okay. So you're going to start by visiting the emergency department and the trauma bay, where you have a 7-year-old boy who's brought in by his parents after he was riding his bicycle and ran into a curb and crashed off of his bike pretty hard. He's crying. He's awake and able to respond to you, but he is covered in quite a few abrasions and contusions and seems to be in a lot of pain.
Okay. First, I would start out with my ABCs. I would assess his airway. He said he's crying, so it sounds like his airway's intact. I would listen for breath sounds. And while I'm checking circulation, I would have the nursing team establish 2 large bore IVs.
Okay. The nursing team is able to get 2 large bore IVs into him peripherally. His airway is intact to voice, as you noted. His breath sounds are clear and equal bilaterally. He does have peripheral and central pulses that are intact, strong, and equal bilaterally. He has vital signs of a heart rate of 110, a respiratory rate of 22. BP is 110 over 65. He's satting 100%, and he appears to be breathing reasonably well.
Okay. Next, I would move on and check disability. So I would see if he's able to move all of his extremities, try to get a GCS and see if he could follow my commands.
He's able to follow all your commands and move all his extremities.
Okay. I would get some warm blankets and totally expose the child.
So you do a full secondary survey. You see abrasions and contusions all about his torso. He doesn't have any active bleeding, and you don't notice any deformities consistent with broken bones. He's neurovascularly intact everywhere. On abdominal exam, he does have pretty exquisite tenderness over his epigastrium, but no diffuse peritonitis, no rebound or guarding. You go ahead and do a fast exam on him and find that there's no free fluid in the abdomen, no pericardial tamponade or effusion, and normal cardiac activity.
Okay. I would send off a set of labs, and specifically for him, I would send a type and screen, a CBC, and a chemistry, including LFTs.
Okay, they're sent.
Can you describe the abrasions that he had? stratified?
Sure. It's what we might commonly refer to just as road rash, mostly on his left flank, but otherwise on both his anterior and posterior torso. And then he's got skinned up elbows and knees, but these are not tender and he moves them easily.
Thinking, do I want to radiate the kid or not? So I would like to get a chest x-ray. And while I'm waiting for that, I would feel his pelvis. Is there any instability?
There's no instability in the pelvis. His chest x-ray comes back, demonstrates no hemo or pneumothorax, no signs of pulmonary contusions or other abnormalities, no rib fractures or other bony abnormalities, and no abnormalities visible on the chest x-ray in the abdomen.
Okay. Do we know, is mom available to ask if he's up to date on his vaccinations and tetanus?
She is, and he is.
Okay. So unless I'm missing something blatantly obvious, this sounds like a stable child who has what seems to be superficial wounds. The FAST was negative, and he's tender but not peritoneal. So my plan for this kid would be to give him some IV hydration, and I would admit him for observation and serial abdominal exams.
Okay. Over the course of the next 2 hours, his abdominal pain gets worse. His vital signs don't change in any significant way, but his epigastric pain, again, becomes significantly worse. And on exam, he's not peritonitic, but again, appears more tender than he was previously.
Okay. Did his labs come back?
His labs came back. They are all entirely normal.
Okay. Is he having any symptoms of nausea, vomiting, or anything like that?
Anorexia, but no nausea or vomiting.
Okay. Can we do a repeat FAST exam at the bedside and see what that shows?
Sure.
I would do a repeat FAST exam.
You do a repeat FAST exam. Again, no fluid in the pelvis or the pericardium, but he does have a small amount of fluid in the left upper quadrant on the FAST.
Okay. And his hemoglobin has been stable thus far?
That's right.
Okay. I will continue non-operative management at this point. Give him another 6 hours and re-examine.
Okay. His pain is worse, and he's becoming nauseated.
And his vital signs?
Entirely the same.
Entirely the same?
Mm-hmm.
So now the things that are going through my mind is this a splenic injury, or is this like a duodenal hematoma or something like that? Because now he's showing symptoms of nausea. I hate to radiate kids, but at this point I feel like I would take him to the CAT scanner and do a CT abdomen pelvis to look and see what's going on with contrast.
Would you add head, C-spine, or chest on there?
Good point. No, I wouldn't. I would attempt to clinically clear his C-spine.
Okay, so you're able to clinically clear his C-spine with no issues. He has on his CT of his abdomen and pelvis with contrast no evidence of any extravasation, that is, no blush or extravasation if you used PO contrast. But he does have what appears to be a grade 2 splenic injury at the left extent of the capsule. Again, no blush there, as well as a third portion of the duodenal hematoma.
Okay. All right. So given that, I don't see anything that suggests that I need to go right to the operating room, so I would continue conservative management for this child, keep him in the hospital, pain control, antiemetics, and I think daily labs at this point.
Okay. The next day, his labs are all normal, but he has thrown up 3 times. His hemoglobin has dropped slightly. It's 12 grams now, the hematocrit of 36. His vital signs are a heart rate of 120, respiratory rate of 22. BP is 110 over 70.
Okay. Patients with duodenal hematoma can have a prolonged course, which may require NPO up to 3 weeks, I believe, before they could tolerate a full diet. So that's not too unexpected. I would try conservative management, have him on IV hydration, and keep him in the hospital until he's able to tolerate PO.
So you mentioned that it could take up to 3 weeks. You would keep him in the hospital for 3 weeks?
Yes, I would.
Okay. Just on crystalloid during that time?
If he does not improve after 7 days, then I would establish central access in the form of a PIC and start CPN.
Okay. I'm going to move on to the next case. Okay. 1 week ago, you did an apparently unremarkable laparoscopic cholecystectomy on an obese 45-year-old woman with symptomatic cholelithiasis. The anatomy was pretty straightforward when you were doing the case, and you didn't have any concerns during it. She was managed as an outpatient, went home, and resumed her normal activities. However, she came into the emergency department this evening concerned about yellowing of her eyes as well as worsening pain in her right upper quadrant. She says it feels a lot like the gallstones that she had previously, but she thought that you took her gallbladder out, so she doesn't understand why that would be the case.
Okay. So for this patient, I would do a focus history and physical. I would want to know other symptoms related to the pain. Is she having any nausea, itchiness, and how long has it been going on?
Okay. She has been having nausea for the last 2 days. She has not had any itchiness. She continues to have that worsening pain in the right upper quadrant. The one thing that she notes that's a little bit different than when compared to her prior biliary colic is that this doesn't seem to come and go. This seems to be pretty steady and just steadily worsening over time. However, it's in exactly the same area. She can still point to that spot on her belly with one finger. She has not had any fevers or any other concerns.
Okay. I would get a set of vitals.
They're normal.
And I would do a physical exam focusing on the right upper quadrant.
She is quite tender but not peritonitic in the right upper quadrant. The rest of your abdominal exam is entirely normal.
Okay. So now my differential does she have a bile duct leak? Does she have a retained stone or choledocholithiasis? Does she have a missed common bile duct injury? So I would start out with a right upper quadrant ultrasound to evaluate the ducts and around the gallbladder fossa to look for any fluid collection.
Okay, so you get a right upper quadrant ultrasound. There is a fluid collection in the right upper quadrant. However, the intra and extrahepatic bile ducts do not appear to be significantly dilated. You are unable to visualize the distal common bile duct due to overlying bile gas.
Okay. All right. At this point, I would like to get a HIDA scan to evaluate to see where the leak is and if we could visualize the contrast going into the duodenum.
Okay. The HIDA will be available in 2 days.
Great. Do we have MRCP available?
Sure. Your MRI is available now. If you get an MRCP, that does demonstrate free flowing bile contrast into the right upper quadrant fluid collection, and it appears to have a transected common bile duct.
Excellent. Okay. So given that, this patient needs to go to the OR. I would call in my hepatobiliary specialist for backup, but I would plan on doing a common bile duct exploration to identify the leak. And if they're not available in the meantime, I would have IR place a drain for source control to contain the bile until we get it to a center where I could help with
the specialist. So you call one of your colleagues who does a lot of hepatobiliary surgery, and he notes that it may not be the best idea to operate 7 days out from a recent surgery.
Okay, in that case, then I would have an IR guided, you can do ultrasound guided drain placement to contain the bile for now.
Okay, so you place a percutaneous drain for the biloma, then what?
Then I administer the hospital IV fluid resuscitation and make sure that her labs are improving and that she's not getting septic. I would start her on empiric antibiotics, something like Unison, as long as she doesn't have an allergy to penicillin or sulfa, and I would watch her.
Okay. So you do that. 2 days later, she's unchanged. She's putting about 400 cc's of bile out of her drain each day.
And is her physical exam improved?
It's marginally better. She no longer is jaundiced. Her bilirubin is 4, but she still has pain in her right upper quadrant and a lot of tenderness on examination.
Okay, then I would call for help again. I would get a second opinion.
Okay.
I feel like she needs to go to the OR, but...
All right. What do you think is going to happen if you go to the OR?
It's going to be a mess of adhesions.
I would say that's probably accurate.
I'm stuck. Yeah.
Okay. So what are you going to do instead of going to the OR?
I guess I'll call my GI colleagues and see if they can come in. They're not going to be able to... I would try an ERCP and see if they could pass the wire. She's already drained. So I called GI.
Okay. GI does an ERCP. They're unable to cross the transection, and they recommend continued drainage until she can safely undergo surgical repair.
Okay.
When do you think that would be?
Probably 6 weeks.
Okay, and what would you do?
At that time, I would do a common bile duct exploration and...
So you find that you find 6 weeks later that the common bile duct is completely transected. You're able to identify the proximal common bile duct where it's leaking bile, but can't find any... distal common bile duct.
So at that point, I would do colidocal jejunostomy or hepatical jejunostomy.
Okay, great. All right, you're done. That's it.
All right, thank you.
How did you do?
Terrible.
Why do you think that?
I don't know, because I wasn't sure about the timing for taking back a common duct transection. I've never had to deal with one, so obviously... I need to read a little more about that.
Well, I would say the fact that you've never had to deal with one makes you incredibly fortunate, and that's a very good thing. obviously, dealing with a common bile duct injury is easiest at the time of surgery if it's recognized,
right.
And that's not what you had here. But I'm going to back up before we get onto the specifics of the what you did in each individual case, and just say, first of all, your presentation was fantastic. You did a really wonderful job of being confident with what you wanted, not wavering on, you know, you could do this, you could do that. And even when you were basically told in the second case that you couldn't do something, you rolled with it, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. I think it's easy to fall into the trap of repeating information that you've been given, and it's easy mm-hmm. to try to fill up the silence of your thinking with things like filling out a differential diagnosis. You really don't need to do that. There's nothing wrong with giving a differential diagnosis to sort of briefly describe what you're thinking or where your thought process is going, but it's mm-hmm. not by any means necessary. So let's back up for just a second. We'll talk about the first case, the seven-year-old with the duodenal hematoma. Sure enough, I mean, you had the diagnosis as soon as his symptoms presented. There are people who will say that you should immediately scan this patient who has a good mechanism for injury and exquisite tenderness. I'm not one of those. I think that's entirely fine. I think your observation was fine. Again, you're going to specify that you're observing closely, you know, in a monitored setting. You're not just sending the kid home. His vital signs were entirely normal. And again, you're, you know, ready to change your evaluation strategy when the patient changes. We took a little more time getting to the non-operative management of intramural duodenal hematoma. That was, of course, the main goal of this. And, you know, the non-operative management of the spleen doesn't really surprise anyone. So the key here, apart from the, you know, pearl of the actual management of this injury, is getting pretty quickly to the point of non-operative management and then really knowing what you're going to do in the meantime. So we didn't have enough time to go into it as much as I would have liked, but it's really important that when you know you're going to do non-operative management for something or you're going to observe something, that you go ahead and have a very clear plan on what's going to change that management and what you're going to be doing in the meantime. So for this young man who has, you know, a duodenal hematoma and maybe NPO for 3 weeks, by all means, feel free to go right out and say, you know, I'm going to explain to his family that these do resolve on their own a huge proportion of the time, that it's extremely unlikely he'll need surgery, but that it may take 3 weeks for his intestines to start working again the way they're expected to. During that time, we're going to give him IV fluid. If it does take as long as I expect it to, then we'll start him on TPN, and he'll be in the hospital with us during that time. If he's stable, he actually doesn't really need to stay in the hospital, but that's in no way going to fail you on this sort of exam. So overall, I mean, you knew exactly what to do on that question. You presented it well. Like I said, we took a little bit more time, and I, you know, strike that both up to me and to, you know, it being our first question that we're going into. So the second one, we went a little faster. It was a quote-unquote straightforward classic case of the post-op lab Coley who has a biloma for some reason or another. Again, your management was just fine. What you did in terms of evaluation was fine. The catch here is that we are a week post-out, and that's really right on the edge of when classically it would be okay to take the patient back to the operating room. More modern surgeons are, you know, learning that we can probably stretch that to 10 days or maybe even 14 days. But remember, again, your classic teaching is going to be at about the 7-day mark is when those adhesions are at their worst, or at least starting to be at their worst. And so it'd be difficult to take that patient back. Your management then is going to be exactly what you, you know, came up with. It took you a little while to get there, so you weren't quite as solid on that question, but you didn't fail it. I think if you had kept pushing for the OR, you might have. So be careful of that. Okay. Realistically speaking, again, your presentation was fantastic. Good work.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was impressed at how you stayed calm. You were very clear. You thought about every question. So I don't agree with your assessment that you did terrible. I think you did very good, actually.
Oh, thanks.
Well, Kevin and Jason, she definitely did better than both of you.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
We thought we'd set the bar really low to start, and to make our listeners feel comfortable.
Thanks, guys.
Sarah not only is doing this in the middle of her call shift, so thanks again, Sarah, because not many listeners on Twitter. You know, we have like, 2,000 followers, and we had to really pull teeth to get two people to volunteer. So thanks, Sarah, for stepping up, even though you are on call.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, and next up to the plate is David.
Hello.
Dr. Strasberg, you ready to do this one?
Yes, sir, Dr. Jones.
All right, so we're going to do exactly the same thing as Sarah. I'm going to greet you at the door. You're not going to knock on the door. You know that this may or may not be your acute care surgery set of cases, and you're going to be very nice and deferential. So let's get started. Dr. Strasberg, I assume.
Dr. Jones, yes, sir.
Come on in, please. We've got a couple of cases to go over. This is not a gotcha exam. There won't be any tricks or anything. I'll try to give you the information that you need, but please feel free to ask for more information. If I'm certain you don't need anything else, I'll let you know. We'll go through these relatively quickly, and they're pretty classic cases. And once again, if anything needs to be said, then by all means, feel free to ask. But otherwise, you can believe me if I tell you you've got everything. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So your first patient is a 75-year-old man who's in the emergency department, and he's coughing up blood. He says that he has vomited blood 4 times over the last 3 days. And he's feeling fine otherwise, but is a little bit concerned about this bleeding.
I will first go see this patient immediately. I will obtain a set of vitals, and I will ask this patient a little more about his history of present illness, exactly when this started, if he's had this before, if he's had any other associated respiratory or GI symptoms, and as well as a past medical history.
Okay. He's never had this before. He doesn't have any other significant medical history. He's a 75-year-old farmer who really doesn't visit the doctor very often. He has noticed that he's had a tiny bit of blood when he vomits over the last month, and he's been vomiting almost every day. He has not had any pulmonary symptoms or coughing of blood. He has not had any melena. He has not had any hematochezia. No fevers, no chills, and no difficulty swallowing, although he does note that he gets full more easily than he used to. He thinks maybe he's lost a little bit of weight, but doesn't typically weigh himself, so he can't be entirely sure. No other significant medical or surgical history, no family history that he recalls, and he lives alone, doesn't smoke or drink.
Okay. I will next perform a physical exam, specifically heart, lungs, and abdominal exam.
Sure. So his heart and lungs sound fine, and he is breathing comfortably. His vital signs are normal with the exception of a heart rate of 110. You do notice just at first glance, he does seem just a little bit of pale skin, and he does have a little bit of blood in his mouth. His abdominal exam shows some significant tenderness in the left upper quadrant, but no peritoneal signs, no palpable masses, pulsations, and no audible bruit. He's pretty thin, and you're able to feel that he doesn't have any significant organomegaly. No other tenderness throughout the rest of his abdomen. You do a rectal exam and find no blood there. While you're examining him, he vomits again, and all in all, there's probably about 50 cc's of red blood.
Okay. May I ask if there's any concern for airway compromise after he vomits?
Doesn't seem to be. He's talking to you well.
Okay. I will then start 2 large bore IVs. I will start crystalloid fluid resuscitation, send off a set of labs for type and cross chemistry, CBC, and LFTs, and I would like this patient to get an upper endoscopy.
Do you do that yourself?
Yes, I did those in training, and I'm comfortable doing those myself.
Okay, so you do an EGD. I guess I should say you admit him to the ICU, you start him on fluid resuscitation. He's hemodynamically stable. His heart rate has now resolved down into about 85 with some fluid. You send off a set of labs, including a type and cross and a CBC, but those aren't back yet. You do an EGD and find that he has a large mass in the body of his stomach, which has some spots of erosion consistent with bleeding. But no ongoing bleeding there. They just have a bit of blood overlying them that you easily wash away. You're not able to see any vessels. At that point.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you cut out for a second there. I'm not sure if you said anything else after no visible vessels.
No visible vessels, no ongoing bleeding.
Okay. I will start this patient as he is admitted to the ICU on a protonics drip as well. And since there's no evidence of varices, I will hold off on giving octreotide or vasopressin. I am concerned that he has a bleeding gastric mass. I'm afraid if I biopsy that, this may cause more bleeding. I would like to see what his hemoglobin has come back as and if he needs any more resuscitation.
Okay, his hemoglobin's 5.5.
I will start two units of packed red blood cells. And I know I didn't ask this before, but do they have a INR on those labs?
It's normal.
Okay. I would continue transfusion for this patient, and I'd like to see how he improves.
He continues to vomit blood every 2 to 4 hours, just around 10 to 30 cc's each time. He is not massively bleeding, but continues to require about a unit of blood every 6 or 8 hours to keep him above 7.
Okay. I have failed non-operative management. I will take this patient to the operating room for resection of this gastric mass with planned reconstruction.
Okay. The patient wants to know if there's anything else you'd like to do before going to the operating room. Do we really have to jump straight to surgery?
No, there are other options. I can ask our GI colleagues if they can inject any epinephrine around the bleeding mass. Other than that, I don't have anything else I could offer him.
Okay. So GI does another scope on him. They do some epinephrine injections, and they ask if you want to do a biopsy of this while they're there.
If there's no active bleeding at this time and there's no visible vessel, then I would like a biopsy at that time.
Okay, so they take a biopsy, an FNA biopsy via the scope and send it off to pathology. He remains in the ICU for observation, and the next day the pathologist is able to look at a quick section and tell you that it looks like they're spindle cells.
Okay. I'm concerned that this patient does have a bleeding mass in his stomach, and he will need a resection. I would also am concerned that he may have other disease, and so I would like to stage this patient for regional local metastatic disease as long as the patient is stable. If the patient's not stable, then he will need to go to the operating room.
Okay, he's stable. How are you going to stage him?
So I would like to get a CT of his chest, abdomen, and pelvis, and also a set of LFTs.
Your LFTs are normal. Your chest, abdomen, and pelvis CT demonstrates a about a 4 centimeter mass in the body of the anterior stomach that has some central necrosis and localized inflammatory changes around it, but no gross invasion into other structures.
Okay. At this point, given the patient has spindle cells and no obvious metastatic disease, it sounds like he has a sarcoma or sarcoma-type cancer of the stomach, and I will go for a resection of this tumor.
Okay, what kind of resection?
I would bring this patient to the operating room, and but prior to this, I would let him know that he may need a total gastrectomy depending on the location of this. I would once I make an exploratory laparotomy, I would mobilize the stomach and palpate the mass and see how far this is from the pylorus and from the gastroesophageal junction.
Okay.
May I ask where the location is on operative examination?
It's in the anterior wall of the body of the stomach, several centimeters from both the GE junction and the pylorus.
Okay. As this patient had spindle cells, I am confident this is this is suggestive of a sarcoma rather than an adenocarcinoma, and this may be appropriate for a wedge resection rather than a full 5-centimeter margin resection. So I will perform a stapled wedge resection of this mass, and I will examine to see if this does not cause any obstruction from the stomach to the pylorus or duodenum.
Okay, let's move on. Okay. You finished that case and you're in the recovery area. Your patient's doing well. However, you're called over because one of your partner's cases is not doing well, and they need a little bit of help. This is a patient who had a AAA open repair about 6 hours ago. He's now hypotensive to the 70s. You're asked to assist in any way you may be able to.
Sure. I will immediately go evaluate the patient in the PACU, and I will obtain a full set of vitals, and I will form a focused history and physical, ask him if he has any chest pain, any abdominal pain, any signs of peripheral ischemia or any symptoms of peripheral ischemia, and I will perform a heart, lung, abdominal exam and check for central and peripheral pulses.
Okay. You do all of those things. What you find out is that this gentleman had a 5.7 centimeter infrarenal abdominal aortic aneurysm. He had a transabdominal repair of this with a Dacron graft. During that case, they did have a significant amount of blood loss, so he got 6 units of packed red blood cells and about 10 liters of crystalloid during the case. He has no other prior medical history except for some known coronary artery disease, though he's never required any intervention for that. He takes a beta blocker every day, but does not have any other medications. He, at this point, has vital signs of a heart rate of 120, blood pressure of 70 over 40, a respiratory rate of 22. He's complaining of pain in his abdomen, but he is able to speak with you and carry on a conversation. That's about all you need at the moment.
Okay. I will ensure that he does have large bore IV access and continue fluid resuscitation with crystalloid fluid. I will also send off a set of CBC chemistry and coags, and I will also send for a type and cross. I would then like to admit this patient to the intensive care unit. And I believe did you tell me the abdominal exam?
Probably not. He has a mildly distended abdomen, a midline stapled incision without any significant ecchymosis or drainage, and he is tender throughout the abdomen but without peritonitis.
Okay. I'd like to perform a rectal exam as well.
What are you looking for?
I'm looking for blood specifically.
Okay, there's no blood.
Okay. If this patient hasn't already, I would make sure this patient has a Foley catheter, an arterial line, and that he does have central access in case the patient does need vasopressors. Can I also ask if he had palpable femoral and distal pulses?
He does have palpable distal pulses. He does have palpable femoral pulses. He has Foley in, but isn't making much urine. Once you put it in, you got about 50 cc's of dark red urine out, dark yellow urine out, hasn't made much since then. You put a central line in him and transduce a CVP, which was 4. You also went ahead and sent off the labs that you mentioned and found that his hemoglobin was 9.7 and the rest of his CBC, coags, type and cross, and chemistries were essentially normal. Were there other labs you wanted to send?
No, I think those are appropriate for right now. I actually would like to send more labs. I would like to obtain some urine lights from the urine that's obtained from the Foley. I'm concerned the patient may have ATN as well, and I'd like to see where we're at with that.
Okay, it's sent.
Okay. I will continue fluid resuscitation for this patient and continue serial abdominal exams. Has his heart rate or blood pressure improved at all?
No, not so much. His heart rate's now 130. His blood pressure is still 70 over 40.
Okay. I will obtain an EKG and send off troponins. And I'll also like to send for an arterial blood gas.
Okay. His ABG shows that he has a metabolic acidosis, does not have any apparent component of respiratory acidosis or alkalosis, but he's still at 7.31 on his pH. He has a troponin that's on your rapid troponin assay, less than 0.1, and he has an EKG that shows sinus tachycardia.
Okay. I will continue monitoring his patients in the intensive care unit. I apologize for asking again. Can you tell me what his blood pressure was?
70 over 40.
Okay. I will continue blood resuscitation and start him with O negative blood if his type and cross isn't back. And I will start this patient on norepinephrine.
Okay. How much norepi?
I'll start at, I believe, 0.1.
Okay. I think that's good. How'd you do?
Well, I have to say, after listening to Sarah, I think I said a lot more ums and ahs than she did. I thought she did a really good job with that. I think I did a very poor job with that. You know... Some of the other things I thought is, I guess I wasn't expecting some of the things that you were going to tell me. So some of the things in my differential, I started going through and talking out loud, and I saw that they were going in different direction, and I felt that I was just wasting time with that. And as you said to Sarah before, I probably should have kept those in my mind and not said those explicitly. And hopefully I did the right thing for those two patients.
Yeah, I think you did fine. I'll start by saying I honestly don't think you had more ums and ahs than I do, so I think you're fine there. Remember, this, even though we do talk a lot about presentation, this isn't like a practiced presentation that you're giving, so you don't need to worry about a little bit of that as long as it's not terribly distracting. I think in general, your style was fine. I think you probably did say a little more than you really wanted to in terms of your differential diagnoses and what you're thinking. Most of the time, you know, the examiner is going to be able to tell what you're thinking by the specific questions you're asking. I think the times when somebody will, and I'm not saying you need to do this, but that somebody will give a little bit more information on their differential is if they really look like they're shotgunning, because you don't want to do that. You don't want to send off every lab you can possibly think of. You don't want to send off every test you can possibly think of. You want to be as focused as possible. So I think the time not to do that is if it looks like you're ordering a lot of things, then you'll, you know, say, you know, this is specifically because I have this broad differential diagnosis. One of those times when you're going to have a broad differential diagnosis is hypotension following a major surgery, especially in somebody with risk factors and so forth. So you can say that the diagnosis, the differential diagnosis for this is extraordinarily broad. I'm going to concentrate initially on PE, bleeding, myocardial infarction, and ARDS. I've already decided that it's unlikely to be this one and that one, so I'm going to send off these labs. That's okay. Again, as long as you keep it relatively brief and it doesn't sound like you're stalling to, you know, decide what you want to do. Remember, it is okay to take a moment to think. A little bit of silence is really all right, but if you're going to take more than that, then yeah, it's fine to talk a little bit about what you're thinking. just recognize that if you do, the examiner is going to know that, you know, you are needing a little bit of time. You're not fooling anybody. If it's just there to actually gather your thoughts, that's perfectly fine. In terms of the individual cases, you know, again, the timing's a little bit off, but you basically did three cases instead of two, and that's part of the reason why. So it's not uncommon to have what sounds like a straightforward case that then turns into something completely different from what you were expecting. So it's really important that those SCORE core procedures and core diagnoses or common diagnoses are ones that you have absolutely down, so you can just fly through those. So make sure you know your management of your upper GI bleed. They may not give you as much leeway. They may say that, you know, this patient's already been partially worked up and has been found to have a bleeding esophageal or a bleeding gastric mass, and how are you going to deal with that? But realistically speaking, they want to more concentrate on one workup or another. As an acute care surgeon, of course, I was more interested in what you would do for the upper GI bleed. How do you think you did on that?
I think I did okay. I didn't say I admitted patients to the ICU, and I'm glad that you helped me with that. I initially didn't biopsy the mass because I wasn't sure what it was, and I wasn't sure if this was something that would cause more bleeding. And, you know, I've been told about the goal of the oral boards to try to get to the patient to the OR. So I think I had that in the back of my mind, and I could have tried the endoscopic techniques first.
Okay. I think, you know, a lot of people have talked about that. And, of course, being an acute care surgeon, being a trauma surgeon, it's a little bit different for us. We don't necessarily want you to take the patient straight to the operating room. You know, the operating room is also where you can do a lot of damage, like in the post-op biloma that I talked about with Dr. Bushkowski, and in this upper GI patient going to the operating room with likely cancer without a diagnosis. Tough to say, you know, if you should concentrate on getting to the OR. I generally would say, again, do what you would do in real life. Don't try to guess that the examiner is trying to get you to the operating room, because remember, they're not generally as interested in whether you can do the technical portions of the surgery. For straightforward surgery, they assume you can. They're more interested in whether you can make the right decision regarding a complex patient case like these. You know, turning an upper GI bleed into a gastrointestinal stroma tumor resection, it's questionable, right? Which one are they testing you on? Are they testing you on both? Are they testing you on something completely different? So be ready to answer those questions. But in general, you don't need to worry about where the examiner is trying to get you as much as just what you would do in real life. In real life, this patient, you know, would have a workup for a week before going to the operating room, even if he needed to be transfused a couple of times every day. I would say be a little bit more methodical with your upper gastrointestinal bleeding evaluation. So, you know, you do your upper and lower evaluation. You place an NG and flush and try to aspirate. You do some imaging if necessary, and if the patient is stable, again, you get the idea. There's a lot of things to do before going to surgery for an upper GI bleed.
Sure.
The one major intervention that you didn't talk about doing was the possibility of interventional radiology for this mass. I would have told you they squirted them and found no active bleeding, and that wouldn't have helped you. But again, it's one step before going to the operating room for ongoing upper GI bleeding. The other thing I'll say for both of these cases, again, we talk about it in trauma all the time, but both of these are patients who are in an emergent situation and could very rapidly deteriorate. You did exactly the right thing by saying that you were going to immediately go to the patient's bedside and examine them, but then you went to the, you know, more or less typical evaluation of, well, I would ask them a history. I would find out, you know, how long this has been going on. And that's okay. You're going to want to know that. But nobody is going to fault you in these emergent situations for saying, I'm first going to check their airway, breathing, and circulation. Again, okay. Get yourself into that mindset of some of these cases being emergent and treating them as such. That doesn't mean they have to be a trauma. That just means they have to be, you know, acutely ill. I will say it is possible to get yourself into a little bit more trouble that way. On one of my mock oral exams in residency, I, you know, said something about checking airway, breathing, and circulation, and the examiner just looked at me and said, he's in the office. He's here to see you about an elective surgery. And so that may have been a little over the top.
Oh, sure.
But overall, again, good work. Obviously, knowledge on those sort of textbook issues like post-op hypotension and upper GI bleed is where you're going to spend more of your time. Again, just to make sure that you have those down cold so that when they do throw you a loop like, hey, by the way, there's spindle cells on the biopsy, then you'll be able to concentrate more on those things.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for the feedback.
Absolutely. Good work, David.
So where were you going with that second scenario? The guy that was kept, you know, he was persistently hypotensive. Where were you going to?
I was going to go, and honestly, this is what I have in my notes. I was going to go for whatever the last thing Dr. Strasberg checked was. and again, the goal here isn't to say, haha, I got you. You should have had that diagnosis. The goal here is to simply see how you're managing and evaluating a difficult, complex patient. Again, you've got a differential diagnosis on this patient that's a mile long, and there's no way of knowing beforehand what the examiner wants you to do. So just do what you would do in real life. You don't know what the patient has. You don't know which scenario they're going for. Just do what you would do. So again, if he hadn't given any fluid, it was going to be hypovolemia. If he hadn't checked for a hemoglobin and abdominal distension, he was going to be bleeding. If he hadn't checked an EKG, it was going to be an MI. You get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people give some bad feedback about the boards. And a long, long time ago, people will tell you stories about these horrible board exams that they had. And quite honestly, it's not that anymore. Just as Dr. Blotnick was saying on the last couple of episodes, you know, this is designed to make sure you're a safe surgeon, not designed to see if you can guess what random thing the examiner has come up with that day. The way that it was described to me is that this is really supposed to be just a tennis match. They're just lobbing things back and forth. They're saying something, you're saying something, and that's it. It's not a chess match. It's not hardcore beach volleyball. It's just like a backyard, even a backyard badminton match. Just something where they want to make sure you know what you're talking about and want to make sure that you're safe and not doing things off the cuff, especially for the emergency scenarios, whether they're trauma or post-op complications and critical care. These are things that are incredibly difficult to guess what the scenario is going to end up as, but incredibly easy to do as long as you just take that same methodical approach that you would for any other patient.
Excellent.
Well, thank you again to David and Sarah for putting themselves out there in front of thousands of residents across the country and maybe world. And I think they're going to gain a lot from this, a lot of experience and a lot of confidence going into their mock oral exams or oral exams. So thank you again, David and Sarah.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
And Dr. Jones, we can't thank you enough for filling in on a Sunday night and helping educate residents to prepare us for the board. So thanks, Dr. Jones.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
All right. Well, that does it for this week on Behind the Knife. Thanks, guys.
Until next time, dominate the day.